This is the Home Tech Podcast, show number 85 for August 23rd, 2012. I'm your host, Jim Collison, broadcasting live and commercial-free from the AverageGuy.tv studios here in Bellevue, Nebraska, and we post the show each week with world-class show notes out at theAverageGuy.tv. You can contact me or the show, just send us an email, podcast@theAverageGuy.tv. Track me down on Twitter, just at Jay Collison, or follow the show schedule at our Twitter account, at TheAverageGuyTV. We also have all the links to automatically subscribe, download, or stream the audio or video podcast to iTunes, YouTube, Zune, Stitcher, or many of the other podcatchers available out there right on the front page of TheAverageGuy.tv. And actually, tonight I have an idea for somebody who can help us out to make that easier. And so listen for that if you're maybe an iPhone or Android developer. Of course, you can always find us on Reddit, YouTube, iTunes, Google Plus, or even Facebook by searching The Average Guy Podcast. We've been getting a lot of traffic on the Facebook group. And so if you go out to facebook.com/groups/TheAverageGuy, we have a community. There's about 92 of us now, and just about some daily traffic. If you want to post your comments or questions out there, some decent guys hanging out in there to answer back. And some good traffic. So try that out. And actually, tonight's contest to win a LastPass premium code will actually involve Facebook. So get Facebook up and ready to go if you're listening live. If you're listening to the recorded version, sorry, we already gave it away. Don't forget, we also have an Amazon affiliate link out there as well. If you do, if you're going to buy something from Amazon and you want to help support the show, click on the link, buy it through that that banner, and we make a few pennies, and that helps pay the bills. All right, last Tuesday, we did a Rich's Random Podcast Generator, I think number 20, and that's also a part of the Average Guy Network. Rich and I interviewed Amber Gott from LastPass, and about 51 minutes of a show we'll post here. Oh, I think I'm going to post it yet tonight, so if you're listening to the recorded version of this, it's probably already done. And Amber did a great job. We gave away a bunch of LastPass codes, and so a bunch of lucky people will get those as well. We're going to talk about security tonight, and so it's one of those things. If you haven't tried LastPass out, tonight might be a good night to listen why you should use something like that. And if you have any questions, Amber is just LastPass help. So they have a free version you can use if you want to try it. Real basically, it just stores all your passwords for you. So if you have 30 or 40 sites that you have to log into all the time, you can install a client on your PC, and it'll help manage all your passwords. Head out to LastPass.com, and there's some more information, some good videos out there as well. And then last week we did give away the Drobo to Amish Gangar, and I got that out this week to him, and he has it up and running. He let me know he's enjoying it, so congratulations to Amish on the Drobo. And I am minus one Drobo S, which doesn't make me sad because Drobo has some new gear coming out, and excited about what's coming out from Drobo. All right, let me introduce the guests here, and we'll start from my left to my left to your right, I guess is what I was going to say, but all the way to the left here, Andrew Morris. And Andrew has not podcasted with us in about 5 weeks for various reasons. Andrew, it is so good to have you back. How are you?
Yeah, I'm pretty good. I'm pretty good. You're right. I've had vacations and been sick and work commitments and the like, so it's good to finally be back.
Good to have you. What tech stuff has been keeping you busy? Any new tech stuff for you?
The tech stuff that's probably been the highest focus for me of late has been and playing with Android on the HP touchpad. So that's still very much a work in progress. I believe the Cyanogen guys are in the process of looking to start generating the Jelly Bean code for it, which should, in theory, mean that all the hardware is going to work, including the camera now.
Wow.
Which would be kind of nice.
Okay.
Aside from that, we've picked up a couple of new netbooks, so I've been fiddling around with them, getting them ready to roll, and a little bit of testing with Windows 8 to see if it's going to be something that's going to float my boat or not.
Yeah, and we've been chatting a little bit about Windows 8 over the Facebook group, and so if you want to jump in on the conversation, not everyone is particularly happy with the direction Microsoft has gone with that. And I know, Andrew, you're not necessarily a lover at this point.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are struggling to come to grips with the tiled interface. you know, I think we've become so entrenched since 1995 of having the start button and associated start menus and everything that now it's going away, that there's a lot of people who are quite upset about that.
Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah, it's definitely, I tell my friends that it's divided the Microsoft community in a lot of ways, and there's guys that really like it, and I probably fall into that camp of really liking it. And then there's some folks who are like, I can't stand it. I'm not going to use it. Don't force it on me. And, of course, you don't have to upgrade, right? I mean, you don't, right? Yeah, Windows 7 is going to work for a long time. So it's not like Microsoft's going to force you to. But I you know what I'm seeing? A rash of Windows Vista laptops that people have come to me that are having problems with them. And I'll be honest, I'm going to recommend they upgrade those things to Windows 8 for $40. And let's just call it done. So,
although I was listening to a podcast the other day, it was a home server show going back to round about January, where one Jay Collison was saying that he'd never use the Metro interface.
Yes, I did. One Jay Collison said, "I will not use the Windows, or I will not use Metro on the desktop." Is what I said.
Okay.
And I've changed my mind. You know what changed my mind was Windows Server 2012 Essentials. After
really?
Being in that, working through that, we did that first. Look, if you go out to our YouTube channel, we did a first look video right after it came out. And I started messing with it. I'm like, these tiles aren't that big of a deal. I can get through this. I can see through them. So anyways, we'll talk a little bit more about Windows 8 as we go on. But yes, I did say that. So thanks for calling me on that, Andrew.
Oh, good.
Standing next to Andrew, of course, is Brian Auer. And Brian is a big contributor over at the homeservershow.com forums and just an overall good guy. And recycles, make sure batteries get recycled back into the environment safely and soundly. Brian, how are you?
I am doing sort of okay at this point. I'm heavily medicated.
That's always good to podcast when you're medicated. You had a procedure today, and you still worked through it, and you still came on the podcast.
Yeah, I have a herniated disc, so I had a first of three steroid epidurals done
okay.
today.
Well, we're glad you decided to make it. Thanks for coming out. The recycling business doing all right? You guys still doing what you do with batteries?
Oh, going full throttle.
Yeah. Well, good. Good to have you on the podcast, and thanks for coming on. Next to him, Christian Johnson. Of course, Christian is back from his NASA internship and starts school here quickly and is probably busy. Did you get the fall wrapped up with NASA, Christian?
What do you mean? Oh, yeah. I start my new contract September 4th.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So you're in like Flynn, that's all good, and you'll work part-time for them and then give us some NASA secrets during the...
Let's not get crazy now.
Okay, geez. Hey, we never did get interns on here, so you'll have to track down a few of those and so we can interview them, maybe do them.
You going to crash the Mars rover like Wallowitz?
Yeah. I don't know. It has a laser on board. I don't want to mess with it.
Some new video coming out on the Mars rover, which is just dynamite, and where they're actually showing the... lid come off and that thing coming down to the ground. You know, they took a bunch of pictures and then put them all together in a video. So it's pretty interesting. So, Christian, great to have you back. And I know you're getting ready for school. And then Nathaniel Lindley, who joined us on Rich's Random Podcast Generator number 18, about a month and a half, or maybe 2 months ago.
July 3rd.
Yeah, we don't get many of those shows done. That's right. You were on a little bit of a vacation and you decided you did it from a remote location, right?
Yeah, we were over at my dad's place, and then we were watching fireworks right after the show.
Yeah, I appreciate you doing that. Good to have you back on.
Thank you.
Nathaniel, let's transition right into you. Guys, feel free to jump in at this point, ask questions, or if you want to add your own comments in. But I asked Nathaniel to come on. Wanted to talk a little bit. He kind of volunteered to me. He said, hey, let's talk about this this breach that happened. There was a pretty influential blogger out there. Matt Honan, right? Am I pronouncing that right, Honan? Whose account was through various methods of social engineering and maybe not so secure systems, had his Apple and Amazon accounts hacked, and then his remote wipe on his laptop. So, Nathaniel, walk us through a little bit, just kind of dialogue through that story, and tell us what you know, and then we'll kind of dialogue with you as we do that.
Yeah, right. Well, Matt Honan is a senior writer for Wired magazine and been in the technology business for many, many years. And he goes through a quite lengthy, detailed story about how his iPad, his phone and his MacBook all got remotely wiped by some hackers, a small group of hackers. And that's the short version. And what he did was he started a dialogue with the hackers in order to find out what happened. How did you do this? Where did I go wrong? And he found a lot of interesting information about how they acquired that ability. So this group basically did social engineering. They didn't brute force any passwords. They didn't guess any passwords. They didn't need to. They contacted both Apple and Amazon over the phone and pretended to be Matt Honan and got them to give the hackers information that allowed them to reset his Apple password for his .me account. And in doing that, they could daisy chain into other accounts like his Gmail and Twitter and erase his devices with the remote wipe functionality. So he courageously, I think, went to the length of communicating with these hackers and getting them to dialogue through it and find out why and what was the strategies used. And he spent a great deal of time working with Apple trying to figure out what happened. And we all learned a tremendous amount from his experience, and it was pretty bold of him to put his personal reaction to the side and share what happened with the rest of us, because it's really eye-opening.
So he didn't get – he didn't flame or go crazy out there. I mean, was it a pretty controlled, hey, something's going wrong here, what's going on, that kind of – was it that kind of reaction?
Yeah, well, I think he kind of was at home, and then his phone rebooted, and he's like, well, that's odd, and then – he thought, you know, there's a software glitch, and then he went to his computer, I believe that was next, or his iPad, and found that that was wiped. And then he kind of started to realize something was going on, and that was out of his control. It wasn't a software glitch. But to be able to kind of deal with it in a scientific way and not an emotional way is remarkable. And there's a video he posted later kind of about a recap, and yeah, he definitely had some emotional, almost like steps of grief to go through it. But he's really done us all a service by sharing this and opening up some of the loopholes and the problems with your digital identity and security nowadays.
And so, did he lose everything? I mean, did they wipe everything out? Is it all gone?
Well, originally, they did the remote wipe of his laptop. Now, his iPad and his phone, he backs up, so he didn't think, you know, to worry about it. But his laptop wasn't backed up for about a year. So everything he had in the last year on that laptop was not backed up, including pictures of his kids or his young daughter that he didn't have anywhere else. So as I understand it, the remote wipe feature didn't erase everything but locked it out. He does detail taking his MacBook Air to Drive Savers and kind of explains what they do, and they are able to recover everything, which is remarkable because I thought a remote wipe was supposed to be a remote wipe, but somehow it didn't complete the process.
It's still there. I think that's has some discussion all in itself, right? So I know from an enterprise perspective, we have the ability to remote wipe devices in our enterprise if somebody tries to access them up to a certain number of times. It'll automatically remote wipe the machine. Now, this is what this is supposed to do, and we think that it's going to wipe that out, but, I mean, it really just maybe in this case wipes out the table associated with the data, but all the data is still there. I mean, is it really like just a quick format for the most part?
It sounds like it. He's a MacBook Air, and I'm guessing from what I read that he wasn't using the File Vault 2, which is whole disk encryption. And I think that's why they were able to recover it, because, yeah, the file allocation table and that was erased so that it appears like nothing. But then they're able to look at the real, I think they call it the hex bit level of the drive, to pull out files that are of certain types. And those are on SSD, so they're pretty sophisticated.
There are, on the Windows side, there are programs that will recover data, I mean, that the average person can use to recover data that's wiped out or deleted by accident. Is this level? I mean, could he have pulled that drive out and put it into an external docking station and run some regular tools on it and being able to do that? Did he need to pay the $1,600 to get that data off? Do you know?
I would be skeptical if Consumer Tools could have done it. I don't know. I mean, I've used Drive Genius and other tools that recover damaged drives and get data off. But being an SSD, I don't know. He said in his article he didn't want to try is that level of risk and let the professionals take care of it.
Now, to him, you had put in the show notes the bill was $1,600 to get this data back. That's what that data was worth to him, right, at that point. Might have been easier to come up with a backup solution, you know, earlier. You had put in the notes some things that he learned through this. So what outline those for me.
Well, I think what he learned and we can all take away is that you got to have a backup, even on the device that you think is not as critical. And he said in one of his articles he had a desktop where he had most of his stuff and that he backed up and was careful with, but he didn't back up his laptop. And so, you know, that's number one there. Always have a backup. And then the other thing that led to this kind of incident was that he had too many similarly named accounts linked together. So his .me account or me.com or whatever Apple calls it, was the same handle as his Wired account, which is the same handle as his Gmail account. And so they were able to guess that m.n was the same as M. Honan in his other cases. So too many accounts, his recovery accounts were too similar that they could kind of guess it. The other thing he brought to everyone's attention is the bad security practices on Apple and Amazon's part.
Now what? Bad security on Apple's part? How can that be? Say it isn't so. Sorry. That's just a Windows jab. There's a Windows jab.
It's good to, you know, bring that out. It makes us all stronger. But what's happened, I think, is Apple has creeped up on us as being that account is more important. So at first it was just, you know, useless email and some other things. And then it's, I can buy my apps and my music through it. And now all of a sudden I have complete access to my devices through this email that I took casually. And so those remote wipe Find My Mac features are much more powerful than we kind of thought because it snuck up on us. And there, he said that all you need to do to reset an account over the phone is have the last four digits in the billing address, last four digits of your credit card in the billing address. And several AppleCare representatives confirmed that. He had other staff from Wired go through the same steps that the hackers did and prove that it was true what they did, that social engineering. Now, since then, I think Apple has changed their policy. But I'm not sure. Amazon might be a little tighter about adding credit cards over the phone to an account without a little more proof, too. So,
but yeah, I guess at the end of the day, at the end of the day, social engineering is just that, isn't it? If you can convince the guy on the other end of the phone that you are who you claim to be, they've got no reason to disbelieve you.
Yeah, it's, you know, you kind of get stuck. So the hackers called Apple, but they didn't know those security questions.
Yeah.
And I mean, well, I don't know. I can't remember it. And that's all of us. I mean, how many of us remember the security questions we made up a couple of years ago unless we write them down or they're obvious, which in case they're no good. So, yeah, it is a real challenge. How do I prove who I am and you who you are?
Yeah. I know Microsoft are a lot better. I've got a Hotmail account that I created about 4 years ago, and I can't remember the password. I can't remember what my security questions are. I've spoken to them, and they will not give me any access to that account.
Wow.
So it's dead to me.
Well, just make a new one.
Yeah, and I did. That's what I did, yeah.
You know, so as Microsoft, and we'll talk about this later, Windows 8 comes out, there's going to be a movement to log in to Windows 8 with your Microsoft ID. There's a lot of benefits that come with that when you do that. You have access to your SkyDrive and some email capability and some things that just make that a lot easier, including all the apps that you buy in the store and those kinds of things. And so, you know, hopefully Microsoft takes a cue from this and looks at it carefully and makes sure, because this absolutely could happen on the Microsoft side as well, with everything being tied to that Live ID or Outlook.com ID or Hotmail ID, any of those three that are available for that platform.
Yeah, as we move more to a single identity attached to so many things like your SkyDrive and your mail and everything, it's a lot more important that that is secured and not social engineer crackable and things like that. It's I heard someone from Microsoft describe the identities that we've had. So historically, we've had a physical identity, my body and my physical self, and we've grown to a legal identity and my civil rights and my legal persona, and now this digital identity, which we're all growing and learning and trying to figure out how it works and what's privacy, is something that we as a society are just kind of baby stepping into.
Now, we had talked about a product like LastPass. I mentioned that earlier when we started the show. In fact, we're going to give away, I forgot to do this right up front. So we're going to give away LastPass. First person that goes out to the Facebook group and leaves a comment there for me saying they're watching the Home Tech Podcast tonight will win that. So it's a race to get out there and make, and by the way, hosts, you're not included in that.
Oh,
so.
Damn.
Just saying, you can't do it.
I never win anything.
Sorry, Andrew. Okay. So LastPass. He was using something like LastPass in this case, right?
Talk a little bit about that. I was surprised. He was using 1Password by Agile Software, which is a really great password management tool. And I especially love the way the developers designed it. It's beautiful, beautiful software. But he couldn't get into it because he couldn't get to it on his devices. They were wiped. So he didn't even know a lot of the passwords he needed to get to his account. So that was a real kind of a catch-22. And I'm not 100% sure, but I think 1Password is not stored in the cloud, so there wasn't a website that he could log into to retrieve that data, which is one thing that separates it from LastPass, where LastPass is a cloud-based storage. 1Password stores a database, and a lot of people put that database in their Dropbox, but if you don't have a computer that you can log into, you're kind of stuck.
Yeah, so kind of a, it's a, you think you're okay, but then when the bridge collapses, you're on the bridge when it goes down.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, so let's talk about a little bit about that. What what are some practical things that we can do to avoid this? I mean, as we look at this, guys, I'll open this up. Nathaniel, let's start with you. I know you got a few things in the notes there. What do we do? And then guys, jump in as you've found other things that you've tried.
Well, the big thing for me, the takeaways is, like I said at the beginning, you got to back up. And even if you don't think it's critical, you forget later that it is. So that's something that's easy to do. There's so many solutions. Just got to do that. I still believe strongly in the use of a password manager, whether it's 1Password or LastPass. But think carefully if you put all your eggs in one basket about scenarios in which case, how do I get in? And how do I recover things if I don't have my own device? And which passwords do I need to know? And which ones can I hand off to the password manager?
Yeah, let me say some of that real quick. So if I have two forms of authentication, right? If I have my username and password, which is one form, and maybe I'm sending that second form to my phone with a PIN number that I put in, right? That would be two-factor authentication. And my phone is stolen in the process of this, right? I'm kind of screwed from a two-factor standpoint, right, at that point?
Well, that's the dilemma. You know, multi-factor means more than one. And actually, name and password would be two, and a third device would be three multi-factor. And so if you're dependent on that phone being available to log in, and that's wiped or stolen, what are you going to do? So a lot of sites have that, well, I don't have my phone, or I don't have my little dongle device, and then they do an email reset or a loop. But if you don't have access to your email because it's been disconnected or wiped, you've got some thinking to do about that. And I have to think about it myself, like, what if, what if, what if? So one of the things to take away from this is don't link a recovery email that's commonly used or easily guessable. So in his case, m star 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 n at me.com was easy to guess, as his recovery address. So what I would recommend is you create a recovery email account that's not published and not well known, that you can keep the password in your head so that you could go reset or get into your password vault. That's a lot more work, but it kind of helps plug that hole.
So what you're saying is, so maybe I should go to an obscure service of some sort, or even a Yahoo, and maybe register a help me, I'm Jim email at yahoo.com, right?
It's really me.
Yeah, that you'll have to remember. It's something you'd have to remember, right? But it's your emergency email. Maybe you write down that information, you lock it up somewhere separate, so that you don't forget it, like in Andrew's case where he says he's got this Hotmail account that he can't remember and get into. So you would want to secure that information somewhere that's not tied to all your other IDs, right? You don't want to lock that up in Dropbox or lock it up in LastPass, because you may not be able to get into those places. So maybe lock it up someplace physical where you know you can get into it, right?
Yeah, some sort of physical recovery might be a good idea. And just remembering, you know, if you use a Hotmail account or a new Outlook.com, just have the username be somewhat obscure, or at least not obvious to other people that are trying to see what services you're on, that you can use that as recovery.
Okay.
And I would say if you can stomach multi-factor for things like your Gmail or your password manager, I would really recommend it now, because we've seen more articles come out that passwords are weaker and weaker, and the crackers and the hackers have more and more powerful tools to get through them, whether it's through social engineering or brute forcing or other methods. That single username and password is just not strong enough anymore.
Christian, we've talked about this before, but it's probably worth mentioning again. You've got kind of the way you choose passwords. You do something fairly unique, right?
Yeah. So I pick a I memorized a router encryption key, so it's 26 alphanumerics. And then what I do is I create a siphon for each new password I generate. So I basically have certain sequences within that master string where I know where to go to. So I have it's pick door 1 through 5, and you pick door number 3, right? And then once you get into door number 3, you have another 3 set of options. So that's kind of how I generate all the sub ones, so that when you're typing in a password, it's not that whole 26 thing. It's probably 8 or whatever. And that way, if you forgot, and the worst case scenario is that you forgot whatever password was for that account, all you would have to do is step through each door in your head again until you got the right one. So,
and you don't have that written down anywhere? That's just up here in the noggin?
Yeah.
That's serious, dude.
Yeah.
You know, if I can't understand your scheme of how you create those passwords, that's pretty secure. That's probably a good thing. Maybe I'm the only one, but I didn't follow that.
No, it's fairly complex, and it's a great scheme, although I think the average guy might struggle a little bit with that, but... That being said, if you can come up with something unique like that, right, that works for Christian. Whatever it is, he memorized a long string of you know, numbers and letters and characters. Are there characters? Well, I don't answer that question. So I don't hear that. There was some social engineering right there, Christian. I was
trying
to
tell me your login.
Yeah, give us an example of what that could look like. But I think for the average person, you need to find that. And I've heard people say use a phrase. So start with a phrase that you know you're going to remember, and then take each letter that starts, you know, the letter that starts each word, both capital and lowercase, and make that a part of your password.
See, the thing that makes me worried about that is, you know, that person who's going to have the password of kitten, and then their next one's going to be kitten 1, and then it's going to be dogs, and then dogs 1.
There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
Well, actually, there is. I was going to add this. Ars Technica just had a really good lengthy article about why passwords are weak and crackers are better. And I read this, and a lot of the conventional thinking I had about password design and strategy is debunked. And now I'm a little disappointed that all these concatenations that we make up in our head and strategies may not be as secure as we thought.
Really?
So the article details out, and again, it's pretty lengthy and detailed, that because of all these big breaches for companies like LinkedIn and eHarmony and all these other ones where they get the huge lists of hashes of all the passwords, and these cracking tools are getting faster and faster because of really high-powered GPUs, they know 80, 90% of the passwords by the hashes right away because they're so common. And then they know this large database of passwords and huge lists, and they can start to see patterns because people are by nature searching for pattern, and we create things that are patterned and logical to us. So, for example, people commonly use a name and then four digits for a year, so Christian 1984. So when they're trying to crack this password, they don't have to put in characters into the brute force attack, or they can know that the first two numbers are probably 19 or 20. So it really limits down the possibilities that these passwords can be. So I think the last I heard is that huge breach of LinkedIn passwords, they have 90% of them cracked already. Mm. But that last 10% or 1% or whatever it is, those are the truly random high entropy passwords that don't follow a pattern of camel case or whatever. And it's very disappointing because we can't remember random things very well. Christian can, but...
Well, it is hard. I find that difficult. And you said earlier, you know, I'll just disclose this. I've said this before, and it's even some of my posts. I pick the same handles in a lot of the places I go. In fact, I've even said I like to be the first. I get on these platforms, and I like to be the first on them because I try and get a particular, you know, I want that username to be the same, because when it's not, I'm screwed. When I come back to it, I can never remember what that is, right? I'm, oh, crap, what did I... And then some places use your email account as the username, right? Well, then that's pretty easy to get a hold of.
Yep.
And so it's going to just continue to get worse as we get more and more and more of this stuff. Brian, do you deploy any kind of unique password scheme that you can give away and not give away what you know your password?
I have a passphrase formula basically I set up. So I might set up something to a weird nature of Jim is smart, and then put like your area code or your zip code behind it.
Okay.
And so I use a weird formula like that because, like, right now at my corporate office, because of all the service accounts I have to manage, I have to remember somewhere along the nature of 140 passwords just for corporate work.
Yeah.
So and you keep those all in your head?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not that good.
Me neither.
And either that or I've gotten too dependent on LastPass that I don't have to remember anything, which could bite me in the ass later on.
Well, and LastPass is horribly addicting, especially when you have it fill in your passwords for you. And so you might create a super secure password that it generates for you, right? And then you go in and you change it with that, and then you're like, it's so secure, I don't even know what it is, right? But it's buried somewhere in LastPass, and then something goes wrong and you can't get into LastPass or what have you, and then you don't even know the password.
Well, when I started my company, we had a password utility toolbox, and the password you needed to get into, an admin that we had for less than 2 weeks changed it, and we lost it all.
Ouch.
So at that point, I don't trust anything but my head anymore. So God help me, if I ever get Alzheimer's, then my company's screwed.
Yeah. You know, it's almost like, remember the old movies where the spy would have a book and he would get a message, and he would go to a page in the book, and then he could decrypt the message by, you know, you almost want to do that with your passwords in some way where you've got, for the average guy, some kind of reference point that you go to. Because if you can't remember, you can, but it would be a good idea to have it in a way, especially, you know, most password hacking is not going to happen by your cube mate next to you at work, right? That's just not going to happen. They're not going to come in and hack your accounts. But so if you've got some information that's hidden in your cube or in something that's, you know, you can pull, maybe it's a reference point you can open to and get it. That might be a solution as well to help you manage at least the start of the password or what it is, or trigger your memory to something. Maybe it's not completely in there, but it's a combination of the two. I mean, we've got to get smarter than the hackers on this for sure.
Well, the responsibility, some lies in the companies and the services. So generally speaking, using your email address as your username to log in is not responsible, because it's your email address is too public. You want it to be public. You want people to contact you. You want that brand recognition and that name. So right. Companies have to start saying you need a username which is independent from your email address.
Yeah.
And the other thing is they have to do a better job of encrypting the passwords. So, you know, straight hashing is not good enough anymore. It's too easy to get around. And limitations in characters, you know there's a problem and things like that. The companies have to get smarter and better. But we also, as users, have to take responsibility of not using the same password in every site and, you know, things like that.
Okay.
Well, even on that, even stuff like our forums here, we really should have it so that your username is also not what's displayed on the forum level.
But then you're going to a level that the average Joe doesn't get. I mean, most people. I mean, and you got to consider what the data is too. I mean, if you're putting something on a forum that's mission critical or business critical or your life critical thing, then you're putting it in the wrong spot.
Well, no,
I treat everything I put on a forum, including the email addresses that I register with, is totally disposable.
Well, I agree with that, but then you go back to something like your Apple ID is also potentially linked to a review you do on an app on the App Store.
Oh, yeah.
No, this is tough. You really got to think through this. You've got to think, okay, where am I posting it? Where does it show up? We've just kind of gotten willy-nilly about it in some ways. Well, Nathaniel, you had some takeaways. Let me just summarize those here real quick.
Sure.
So you'd mentioned one, again, backup is key in this point, and we talk about this all the time in the Home Server Show, we even talk about it here. So if you've been listening to the show for any length of time, you know, back your stuff up. You know, just find some way, at least two forms of backup, and three is best. So get that done. Use some kind of password manager. You mentioned 1Pass. Is it 1Password that he
one
was
password.
Using? And we did LastPass last week. In fact, Jackie won the LastPass here as part of the show. So, Jackie, congratulations for winning that while you're out there. You can use a password manager that has kind of its own questions at times, but you can do that as well. We talked about creating a little used recovery email account, so unpublished. Don't ever use it for anything but that. So that goes in your recovery when they ask you what's an alternative email address they can contact you at. If something goes wrong, you use that. You know, I created at Outlook.com because that was a new service. I created a spam, you know, I just called it my spam account at Outlook.com. And that's the one I give away to spam. I don't even use it. I just give it away to spam places that I think might, you know, pick it up and use it as spam. So you could do that for your recovery account as well. There's no way for us to get around social engineering, right? That's just going to happen. I mean, shred stuff, try to keep it as secure, but, right, the human factor is just so strong there, right?
Yeah, and, you know, those recovery questions, it's just I never put something real. So they'll ask – I'll pick three questions, and I'll put Painter 1, Painter 2, and Painter 3. But as long as I've written down somewhere, this was question 1, and here's the answer. If they're not related, someone can't guess your high school, you know, mascot or things like that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it's good. I just think about all the real answers I put in for those things. And they're supposed to be obscure in themselves, but that's not always the case. And then multi-factor authentication, having it go to two or three different ways, which can be a real pain all in itself.
Yeah.
Especially if you're trying to log into something very quick.
You know, I've been doing that. So I've been using the YubiKey with my LastPass account, which is just the USB dongle that acts like a keyboard. And you can attach more than one. So I've got two, and I keep one at home, and I have one on my keychain to take with me to work and stuff. And at first, you get grumpy because it slows you down. Oh, I got to get it out. But you kind of just get used to doing it, and it's just part of my pattern now.
Yeah.
YubiKey. I just better not lose it.
Yeah, for sure. UBI, right? YubiKey, and that's the other thing, right? You can't. You crush it, you lose it. It gets wet. It stops working. You're screwed, right?
No, actually, they're pretty indestructible. It's UYBI. I'll put it in the chat.
You bet.
But they're pretty indestructible.
And they're, well, nothing's completely indestructible, but they're $25, $30 $35
Yeah, it's only like $25, and there was a special at one point, and I got two of them, and I'm you know, it's so easy. It the computer thinks it's a keyboard, so it's not that you have to have any software anywhere. You don't have to install anything. It just comes up as a keyboard, and then when you put in your name or your email address and your master password, it pops up a window saying, you know, put in your YubiKey, and you just type it in.
Okay, I have to try that. Guys, any other thoughts on things we in there that you'd give advice on from security and password and anything like that? All right, I'll take that as a no. Any other special things that you guys do that might be unique or advice you'd give to somebody from who might be struggling with password security?
Yeah, my take is I use a password that's about 10 characters long that, and I don't know if this is good or bad logic, but I've put it through a password cracker, so I've put it against Lofcrack. Lofcrack takes a couple of weeks to break it, so I figure that I'm probably fairly safe.
Now, what's that? Is that a service? Is that something you can submit, or how does that work?
It's a password scavenging tool that you run against a Windows environment.
So you're running it, and you download it and run it against your password to see if it'll crack.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's basically a brute force attempt on that password.
Not an average guy tool.
The average guy can get access to it,
okay,
but it's not necessarily a tool that the average Joe would be using.
Yeah, maybe the average tech guy.
Yeah.
Okay. Brian, anything? Yeah.
Well, one thing I've started using, especially since the Outlook.com came out, but I was actually using it a little bit before with Live, is since they'll let you have aliases, use your alias email for everybody and then create a email account for your actual login account that only you use for you to log in.
That's a great idea. I got to start doing
that. Yeah, I like
that. I got to start doing that for sure. The problem is most of the sites don't allow you to change it once it's set up. They're not designed to do that. It's hard to go in there and change your username. Some do. Some support it. Some don't.
Well, what you can do is, like, on the at least with the Outlook account, is you can morph your existing Hotmail account or whatnot to being an alias and create a new alias and have that become your login account.
Yeah.
And switch it around. So you can do it with a lot of things, but like I have my Hotmail come in there, I have my Gmail come in there easily as all aliases into separate folders, yet the login account I use to log in and to manage it isn't used for anything else in the world.
That's a really good idea. I've got to start moving towards that kind of scheme for sure. Good. Christian, anything you want to add to that conversation?
If you are going to do a password manager and you're worried about the cloud, I would try the RoboForm because that lets you store everything locally on your machine. So if you're on a machine that people don't have physical access to, then it makes more sense to be storing that kind of stuff locally.
Okay, RoboForm.
Yep.
We'll get that in the show notes for you if you check it out. Okay, anything, Nathaniel, anything else you want to add to that? I appreciate you doing that. That was a good segment.
No, I would just encourage people, we can put the links in the show notes, to go read some of those articles about Matt's experience and his feeling. There's a lot more detail than I got into, and then that Ars Technica about how passwords are weak and Clever is dead. It's really interesting to me, at least, and kind of makes you think about your own scheme and how you could improve it.
Yeah, one of the things the LastPass Premium has is it's kind of like a security checker that you run against all your accounts. And it starts telling you where you have too many passwords that are the same and user account names that are the same and those kinds of things. Sometimes that'd be a nice little health check to go out there and see just exactly. And I got a gazillion accounts, so I am your classic case of someone who's just waiting to get hacked. And
That security check is great. I've been using LastPass for 2.5 years, and so I ran it right away, and then I've run it once a year or every 6 months, and you get to see your score go up as you get more entropy and as your passwords get stronger and you'll have less repeats. So you kind of feel good, like, all right, I'm doing a good job. It's getting better.
Nice.
But as more people join, your rank goes down.
Yeah. Rennie had come on the show a couple months back and talked. There's some sites out there as well where you can, if you think your email has been compromised or that account has been compromised, I think it's called checkmypassword.com or checkmyemail.com or something. I have to go back. I should know that off the top of my head. I get notifications from them when new emails have been added to their database of emails that have been hacked, and that's another good site to go out to and check your. I think it's called checkmy. Rennie, help me out. Put that out in the chat for me so I know what I'm doing. All right, Nathaniel, thanks for that topic. Always good to talk about that. I wanted to throw out a little bit of a challenge to the guys, not particularly you guys, although you could do this if you want, but everybody listening. We got a pretty healthy audience at this point, so I think there might be an aspiring iOS or Android developer out there. I was listening to a TED Talk this last week, and the premise of the talk was there's no such thing as stupid users, only stupid programmers. Or programs, right? We don't, when we develop programs, the ones that don't work are the ones that aren't developed for the users, because sometimes they're just too hard. They're too hard to manage, too hard to get into. I mean, think about how much we've complained about iTunes and how bad that is at times, or, I don't know, fill in, I guess we were talking about how you guys don't like Windows 8, in that the very first tile interface is a little difficult for people to manage. Well, I've always had this question: is why don't people download and subscribe to podcasts more? Why do I get more listeners on the site than I do on their phones? And honestly, it's because I believe that most people don't really either can't figure it out or don't want to figure it out, or RSS is just too hard. Sometimes you gotta go here and do this. I gotta get this and then search for that and put it in, and I gotta click the link. It doesn't work. So I'm gonna throw out a challenge. Any aspiring developer on those two platforms that wants to develop an average guy app that makes it two clicks to get to the podcast for people to listen to. So that would mean they would open it, and the average, all our podcasts on the average guy, this one, Home Tech, Financial Tech, Rich's Random Podcast Generator, would be available right there. And all they would have to do is either they would have two buttons, stream it or download it and listen to it. I'm interested. And then anybody who wants to develop it, if they want to sell it, they're welcome to do that. I'd prefer they don't sell it for any more than 99 cents, because I don't think it'll sell for any more than that. But they'd be welcome to sell it, and they'd also be welcome to make it ad-supported if they want to try that. So I'll throw that out there, and they can own it. It'll be theirs. All I require is that it's got the podcasts in it that people can subscribe, that can easily get. They can find it on the stores by putting in the average guy, and it'll show up. I get that hit a lot in our analytics now, so I know that brand is getting out there. But I'm interested in making it easier for people to listen to the podcast and not make it so hard. I feel like I've got the RSS feeds on the front page, but I quiz Jackie Kingsley, who's out there. She's kind of an average listener that came over from JPEG to RAW. Jackie, have you figured out how to listen to the podcast on your phone? I guess that's what I want to know. Or do you, or is that how you would listen to it? I think if it was easier to do on your phone, more people would do it. So I'll throw that out there. Any of you guys want to try? Anybody? Christian?
I might take a stab at it. We'll see.
I was going to say, you need an app development program, like you need a hole in your head. But I'm sure school starts up here pretty quick for you, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so don't do that, Christian.
It's only a couple of days for Christian, something like that.
You could probably have it knocked out in about 30 minutes. I'm just saying. I do want to talk Windows 8 Enterprise. The eval came out, and a lot of folks have been asking me, Windows 8 came out on TechNet and MSDN, which means you need to be a subscriber to be able to get that. And I've had a lot of friends say, well, I'd like to try that out, but I don't really want to buy a TechNet or an MSDN subscription. And so I wanted to let folks know that you can go out, we'll include the links out on the show notes. You can go out and download a 90-day trial of Windows 8 Enterprise and try that out. And I like it. I mean, I like it on physical hardware, but if you don't have an extra piece of hardware laying around, you can try that in Oracle's virtual box. Very, very simple to do. And actually lots of instructions out there on how to get it done. And if you just have questions or whatever, post a comment on Facebook and we'll help you do that. But that's all available for anybody who does not have MSDN or TechNet. If you want to give it a try and you don't know how to do it, contact me via the Facebook group. Facebook.com/group/theaverageguy, and we'll get it done that way. Guys, you're all trying it at this point, right? I mean, everybody's got it installed. Andrew, you've got it installed in some capacity?
Yep. Yep, I got it installed.
And physical hardware or VM?
Physical. Mm-hmm. I tried it in a VM. I didn't have a host that was up to up to snuff.
Okay. And Brian, have you got it installed on something there? A couple times maybe?
I have it installed on a HTPC in my bedroom and then a laptop for both work and here. And then I also have it installed at work on a development laptop to bring all of our apps up to Windows 8 spec.
Okay. And not a terribly difficult install to do. It's pretty easy, right? I mean, it's pretty much point and click. And you can do it from Windows 7 if you want. I wouldn't recommend it, but you could turn your Windows 7. It'll upgrade it to Windows 8?
It will upgrade to Windows 8. The biggest problem I have right now is custom defining the Metro UI for applications. Because people won't know, a lot of my users don't know what all apps they have on there. And so when you start putting in things like SAP or SharePoint, they can't find the links because the way they get buried.
Yeah, that's going to be an enterprise problem for sure. We've got some trouble on our hands there. That's for sure. Good of you to be out ahead of that a little bit. And do you guys have plans to move to Windows 8 corporately pretty quick, or certainly you're going to hold off for a while?
My CIO wants it, and I've told him pretty much hell no. And considering that right now the Rockwell automation program we use to run the plants, and which pretty much runs most of the United States in plant automations, dies on it. I've got a little bit of a reprieve.
Okay, so yeah, you can't at this point. You can't move to it yet. But he's pretty aggressive about it. Is any reason why he wants to move so fast?
My CIO is a gadget geek.
Okay, all right. So he has the sickness.
Oh yeah, he's as bad as me. We both got Ultrabooks day one.
Okay. Christian, have you, since you've been back, even at NASA, have you installed it anywhere yet?
We have one RTM box that we were thinking about setting up for my mom to see if she can use it. So it's activated and running, but we haven't put it on a desk yet. So.
Okay, yeah. Nathaniel, any is it working for you?
No, I haven't. I've downloaded ISO and I have a TechNet, but I haven't put it on a VM or anything yet. It's time.
Well, yeah, and it is and it isn't, right? I mean, there is no, I think with this version, there is not the, you know, we went from Vista to Windows 7. Windows 7 was just ready. And I think people were ready for Windows 7. I mean, it worked. It worked very similar to Vista. It worked better than Vista. It had a lot of improvements to it. I think as a community, we all went, hey, this is Vista version 2, and it's better. We all just moved to it. I remember that. We just went to it. We did it. That's not the same thing I'm hearing right now in the community, and a lot of people. And you know what? You don't have to do it unless you really want to take advantage of some of the features that come with it. And I would think of some of the storage features and storage spaces in some of the file history pieces that come with it. You have a touchscreen device that you want to take advantage of. In doing that, I don't really think you have to do anything, right? I mean, so, Nathaniel, I know you're feeling a little pressure because we're all messing around with it, right? A little peer pressure, but...
I like to get in there and see it and say, yeah, I've seen what it's like and do it and kind of get that feeling for yourself. But, you know, I've been using Windows 7 at home for a while, and we just started switching at work and catching up with that. And, yeah, I'm going to do it. I just didn't put it off till I got some time to really mess with it. And I'm a big media center user, so you know, I don't want to mess that box up. It's working just fine.
Well, my prediction on it is if you actually go back and look at the history of Windows since Windows 1.0, every other version of Windows Microsoft has released has been successful, and every other version has failed.
I have totally made this point before. See, other people are picking up. This is a good day.
And okay, so Christian, explain how that you've been right.
So, all right. So
oh, no.
In three sentences or less.
I'm just going to give you the sequence. I don't have to sentence any of this. This is like following a tree. So DOS, it worked great. 3.1 was like the starting block for Windows, right? So once we got from that 3.1 to 95 stage, things were pretty smoothed out, right? Then Windows 98, USB support, nope, that didn't work that time. They had all sorts of little weird bugs starting off with that one. So what do we do to fix it? Let's come out with Windows 98 SE, or second edition, to fix all of our original problems. So then everyone loved it because they could plug in their USB devices and things worked right. So then we come to the next block of OS success as a failure, where we had Windows 2000, which was like the pre-XP platform that people were like, all right, let's upgrade. And then Windows ME came out, and it was just the most disgusting operating system Microsoft had ever put together. They even retracted from it. So that was the big failure point. And then the combination of the learning blocks from that is what produced XP. And I may be wrong in the timeline in the sense that I think ME might have come before 2000, but it was in that time era. So XP was the perfected version of the mistakes and failures of ME and at heart 2000, because it was kind of based off what they had done in that 2000
was first.
Yeah, okay, so that makes sense.
I was at Microsoft at that time, so...
Right, so there's that series. And then, lo and behold, comes Vista, which is the next new kernel shift and upgrade that had a lot of good things about it, but the user adoption was terrible because of the security and all that stuff. And then in order to make it user-friendly and have the features of the new kernel and security, lo and behold, Windows 7. So now we're at the point where we're at the top of that plateau again in the release of Microsoft cycle. So now we're at Windows 8. So either it's going to happen in the three stages that it does in certain cycles, or in the two stages that it had happened in other cycles. Two stage being Windows 98 to Windows 98 second edition, and three stage being Windows ME, Windows 2000, and Windows XP. So if we get to Windows 8...
I hate to correct you, Christian, but ME and 2000 were the same cycle because it was when they went to 2003 and XP that they merged the code base.
But what happened was that Microsoft at the time, 2000 was supposed to be the consumer OS, and they could not get the gaming side of it to work correctly under 2000 the DirectX portion of it. And so that's when and I was at Microsoft at the time because I was under the old Windows 9X support, which included ME. That's when we came out with the Windows ME, which got rid of the DOS kernel. We included a little bit better FAT32. We included actually the initial stuff for System Restore built into that. A little bit of the MSConfig was better into that for diagnosing issues. So it was definitely a gear up, and it was a good success, but it was we need something to get out quick because 2000 isn't going to be ready for consumers.
Are you talking about ME or 2000?
Because 2000. They had to bring out ME because 2000 wasn't going to be geared ready for consumers to use.
Well, but I don't want to get too deep into that. Christian, I do agree with your, and somebody, I think Tim had said, it's kind of a TikTok, right? There is a... It's good. Then they try some new things, and that version of the new things doesn't work so well, and it takes them some time to fix it, and they get it fixed, and they have a new version that comes out. I mean, we do see, I think we all agree there's that cycle that goes back and forth with them. And as much lashing as I've taken over Windows 8 in the last couple of weeks, especially in the Facebook group, I do agree. This is a brand new, I mean, Microsoft's never done anything like this. This is a tablet operating system that has Windows built into it. And no doubt there is going to be some confusion and some angst. It's going to come preloaded on every desktop that rolls out at this point. If you go into Best Buy these days, all you see are touch monitors now. And that's all they're selling. I mean, there's two PCs, a bunch of touch monitors, and you know, it's a touch monitor and a PC all in one, and then there's a bunch of laptops and tablets. So I don't know. It's going to be messy at first. I don't think it's as bad as everyone thinks it will be, but it will be a little messy for sure.
I think the first service pack will change a lot of things as well. I mean, Microsoft have got a good history. I mean, even Windows 7 had some bugs in it that were not insurmountable, but we saw a lot of stuff that got fixed throughout the first, what, 6-8 months as they started releasing, you know, reasonably significant hot fixes, and then SP1, you know, put a lot of things into it. I reckon, personally, that Windows 8 SP1 will probably give the option to put back the desktop.
It'll be interesting to see if that actually does happen.
That's my personal speculation. Okay. Yeah.
So that's what you think. Brian, what do you think?
I'm thinking that, just like Andrew, either SP1 or we'll come out with Windows 2008 R2, or I'm sorry, Windows 2012/Windows 8 R2, and just be like what happened with even 2003 or Server 2008, and the R2 will include the original desktop just for go back support. There's too many things I'm running into that fail miserably. Multi-monitor support is horrible with it. My AutoCAD users already can't stand it.
Yeah, and that's something I haven't tried big time yet. I said it on a show, I don't know, a couple weeks ago. Mike Fauché kind of called me out on it in the Home Server Show forums. And so, no, Paul Breran called me out on it in the Home Server Show forums and said, what is this multi-monitor problem that you're having? And so I have yet to really put it on a box that had multi-monitors yet. So I don't know, you know, Brian, I'm taking your word for it that it's terrible. And so when I say it's terrible, it's only because people like you tell me it's terrible. What kind of problems are you having in multimedia support or multi-screen support?
Well, with the whole push for the new office even to be Metro-styled and Metro-based, it's all going to run off of the Metro screen. You can't drag something over to the second monitor.
Okay.
If you log into the IE on Metro, you can't drag it over to the second monitor and have a browser on both sessions. So stuff like that is just ruining it for... I don't run less than 2 monitors on any PC I have other than my HT PC. Even my laptop has... I plug in a USB monitor into it, plus I use my iPad as a third screen on it using... Display Link. So I run 3 monitors on a laptop on a daily basis.
Okay, yep, me too.
Okay. Yeah, good to know. I think there's
And that's interesting, because I think I've used Windows 8 and only like I would multi-monitor remote desktop a Windows 8 box to a multi-monitor computer, and it did it pretty well.
Yeah, and I did a laptop, and I plugged in the monitor into my laptop and had multi-screens, and it does, you know, it puts the taskbar on both screens, and you can switch the Metro interface between. I see what you're saying, though, about having, you've got the Metro, you have to have the Metro or the Windows 8 experience screen on one, and then you can have the desktop on the other, right? Is that what you're saying, Brian?
That's what I'm saying. But yeah, when we're looking at a CAD user like I do, a lot of times I have AutoCAD stretched between 2 screens.
Right.
Because I have all my toolboxes laid out. I mean, I use at work, one of my 2 workstations, I use a ATI card that actually stitches it together so it's one screen for me between both screens. So then you end up with Metro taking up both screens on your monitor even.
Yeah, which is what you don't want, right? You want the desktop on both screens.
I want desktop on both screens.
Yeah. Okay, well, Windows 8 is going to keep us talking about stuff for a long time. If you do want to try it for yourself, if you hadn't tried it yet, you can head out. We'll have the links for it in the show notes. You can go out and download it. It's a 90-day trial by the time... It comes out, Windows 8 comes out on October 26th, which is less than 90 days away. So if you're wondering, hey, only 90 days, well, it'll be available on October 26th for general availability. And you can buy it for just $40, actually, if you want to upgrade your system. So it's coming out. Most of the guys and gals that listen to this show probably know that, but if you don't, it is coming. Okay, we're running a little bit short on time. Brian, anything that you'd put in there before I get to Christian for Christian's Corner? Anything you wanted to talk about just briefly?
In
the notes?
Something that actually caught my eye today during the news, and I've been looking at it and researching it and talking with actually one of the guys on the development side of it, is this new Dyle.tv, D-Y-L-E.tv. Currently available at your Metro PCS stores. It is a cell phone that has basically the old Sony Walkman built into it that actually has a digital antenna built into it to get over-the-air television on your cell phone.
So it's got a tape deck as well?
Well, this is actually running a some sort of Samsung Android on it.
No, he didn't mean to say Walkman. He meant to say Watchman.
Watchman.
Right?
Oh, okay.
Watchman, yeah, okay.
Watchman.
Because the Walkman was like a cassette.
It was
a cassette.
Was a cassette,
but the Watchman was a TV. So they've come out with this, and they're actually coming out with a adapter that will plug into the charging point on your iPhone, iPad, and also an Android device pretty soon. So you'll be able to have live TV streamed to your iOS or Android device without having to use bandwidth.
And is it actually capturing the over-the-air HD? Is that
over-the-air HD? It has a little metal antenna that pulls out for it. Doesn't use bandwidth, so it looks pretty good. It's limited in the markets they actually support it in right now. We're one of the areas, but they do have pretty good coverage over the U.S., it looks like.
Interesting. Drop a link for that in the show notes if you've got that.
I put it there, but I can double-check.
Oh, I see. It's hyperlinked. Yeah, I see it now. Andrew can get that in the show notes for folks. That's kind of interesting.
Yeah. It was something, to me, I hadn't even thought of it. I hadn't thought of it, but they were hyping it as far as storms and people to be able to check in on live TV during a television or during a storm issue or emergency issue such as that. So as we're getting down to tornado season in Texas, it's something that I pay attention to.
Yeah, for sure. It'd be interesting just to have an add-on to drop that on. We just moved this weekend. I just cabled up into the attic. We're going to put over-the-air HD antennas in the attic to get the two. There's two different, we have to point the antennas in two different directions here where we're at. One over into Iowa to get Iowa Public, and one into the different towers here at North Omaha to get Nebraska Public. And so we're going to put two antennas in, tune them up, and then I'll get over the, I get it. I just don't have a very good antenna right now, but over-the-air HD is just dynamite, at least here in the United States. And so it works very well. Recording, it's even better in Media Center, so good stuff. Okay, Brian, thanks. Appreciate that. And then, Christian, you got a few things. Your Raspberry Pi is on its way. By the way, we did a special edition Raspberry Pi with John Zadler and Chris Barnes that came out last weekend, another podcast. But if you're interested in some of the Raspberry Pi basics, we kind of cover that in the podcast. Christian, yours is on its way?
Yeah, so I got a little email from Allied Electronics. So I had been, oh my gosh, since like March on their wait list. And then, guys still there?
Yeah.
It got really quiet, sorry. So I was back on their wait list back in March, and they had finally sent me an email sometime around within the next couple of months that said you can now order a Raspberry Pi. So I think it was around July that I had actually gotten the order after having been on there since around March. And so I ordered it. It was either late June or July, but point being, I finally got a notice today saying that the Pi has shipped. So hopefully it'll be
awesome.
Within the next couple of days.
We've been hoping to have that in your hands for a while. It'll be good to get that in your hands and get some feedback on it. So again, if you're wondering what a Raspberry Pi is, you're listening to the podcast, just go one podcast back. We did a whole show, a whole special on it, and you can hear that. What are you hoping to – do you have any projects right off the bat that you're hoping to do with it, or is just kind of mess around with it?
The immediate thing is actually going to tie into the deal of the week, but – we're working on using it to replace the central command processing for what's called Mr. Jingles, which I may get a NASA guest to come on and talk about. But essentially, one of the things that we're working on for the telecommuting that I'm doing with the information management branch is being able to control a robot from where I am. That essentially it's Android powered. It's got Arduinos for its circuitry for the motor operators, and it would all get tied into the Pi. And basically, the version that we have right now runs off a EEPC with the screen kind of paired off. And
that's an ASUS, right?
Yeah,
it's an ASUS design. Yeah,
right. And so the one that that the version 1 that is working right now, you actually control it with your Android cell phone, so you just tap what direction you want the robot to go to, and it goes and does its thing. But the whole point is that because NASA is moving a lot into the telepresence market and really has a lot of people doing telecommuting, one of the experimental things we're going to try for my fall contract is actually being able to control one. So, like, if I have to go to someone's office, all I have to do is drive the robot into their office.
Get out.
And it's hooked up over what's called video, which is the same video technologies that the Google Hangout runs on. So the version 1 that we have is like a consumer type thing. So it's based off Skype, and this was all work done by one of the contractors who works in my office, and he just really did a cool job with putting everything together. And so when he brought the idea, he put together what's like a telepresence proposal, and they approved it. So we're giving it a try this fall. And so I know they're working on the networking logistics to get it to be interoperable and secure. But once we get that done, I'll probably be working on designing the panel that, you know, controls it from a web interface, because I don't want to be controlling it from a phone. But it's all written in Java, so should be fairly straightforward to port over to a program of some sort for Windows. So it's going to be a lot of fun. So one of the things that is a challenge with switching the main board over from an EEPC to a Raspberry Pi is A, powering, right? So the solution for that is there's actually a powered USB hub that everything runs off of, including the Raspberry Pi. And the second issue, which is ongoing, is, and this is getting in my deal of the week, so first let me introduce the deal of the week, being the double site USB powered monitors. So this sits on my desk now, and I actually use it for sticky notes. You can't really see because of the glare.
It's a little bright. Yeah, it's fine.
There's a bunch of sticky notes on here, essentially, and what it is it's just like having a second monitor on my desktop. So this shows up as a second monitor, and I have it in landscape, landscape. But
that's portrait. That's landscape.
Yeah, landscape. This is landscape. This is what I had it in for portrait, mm-hmm. for the sticky notes. But this is the 7-inch model. The one that's in the show notes is the 9-inch model, which gets the same resolution as the EEE and is like a $129 panel. And then you can also get one with a touchscreen on the 9-inch. And they're affordable. The screen quality is really nice, actually. And all it is two. You just plug in, it takes up two USB ports, one for power and one for data, and that's it. You have yourself a monitor. And it sounds pretty like, oh, I'm never going to use it, but I can't believe how much I've been using these little things for. So not only is it a great way to get, like, because I think a lot of times multi-monitor folks and people who are going from single monitor to dual monitors, one of the biggest things they notice is that while they're working on their main task on one thing, they can still be reading their feeds and all that kind of stuff in the other monitor, which is what they like. And this is perfect for like sticky notes, office notes, if you have like a Skype window and you just want to move it over here. So this is actually going to be the interface screen that shows up on the robot. So that's how people will see me. So my webcam will be getting broadcasted to that screen. And that's basically the robot's face, right? And so then the returning webcam is coming back.
There's going to be a Christian robot at NASA.
Yes.
That is sweet.
It's going to be pretty awesome. So myself...
It's going to be like the Big Bang Theory episode where Sheldon robotized himself.
Yeah, so...
so that's awesome. We have our own robot at NASA. That's pretty
cool. So it's pretty neat.
Can you just flash up the Average Guy logo every once in a while? Maybe that could be your away screen, would be Average Guy.
Yeah, but definitely huge kudos to the guy. I mean, the manager for one of the contracts there is the guy who put this whole... I mean, he did the whole thing from scratch, and then a combination of his genius there and getting the management aspects figured out, I think it's going to be a lot of fun. So,
have you tested? You probably haven't, but could you put the Windows 8 Metro screen on that? So that becomes your touch. So you buy a touch one of those,
yeah,
and that becomes like your mouse, so to speak, your touch interface, right? Sits it right on your desk. then your monitors, the rest of your monitors are open for
Yeah, you
desktop.
Could actually do that, yeah. One of the things I was thinking about doing was having a, so I have the way, you can't see it, but if you're sitting where I am, it's my 24-inch monitor, and then it's a corner desk, which means that there's like two side panels and the top running shelf right above me. So what I was thinking of doing is, I mean, these things are cheap, they're like $130, but I think the Touch one is like $190, but I was thinking about getting three of the non-touch 9-inch displays, and it's the same resolution as this, and so this is my netbook. This is the 10-inch screen on the Triple E, so this is a Triple E, and it's the same 1024 by 600 resolution that 9-inch panel is going to give you. So I was thinking about buying three of them and mounting each one on that top shelf on the corner desk. So I would be looking at my 24-inch monitor, and if I just tilt my head up a little bit, I can read all these. I have all these readouts, and it would basically be 27 inches of screen real estate going across and 9 inches down, and that I think that would be cool. And then if I really got obsessed, the alternate configuration would be, instead of having 3 9-inches running across the top, I would put 2 9-inches with touch on the side, so I could be touching stuff and just dragging and dropping stuff while I have my main screen, and then put 1 9-inch that's non-touch at the top. So that's the other configuration I was thinking about. So the first Raspberry Pi challenge is going to be to get this to have a driver that works on it, because there is a display. Display Link is the technology that it uses to get video powered through USB, and the Raspi distro for the Pi does have a driver for it, but they haven't been able to get it to power up the screen yet. So that's going to be the first task. And
you're going to hack that, aren't you? You're going to hack that and make it work, aren't you?
That's my first project. We're rebuilding a new one for the office, and so we want to have one that's based off the Pi with the driver working, so it's going to be a lot of fun. Yeah,
Christian, you landed the Mars rover, right? That was you?
No, that was not me.
Thinking that was you.
I'm super talented engineers beyond my years.
Yeah, well, I don't know. That's super geeky. Brian, I asked you a second ago, you know, we were saying, could you do that touch screen where you put Metro on the USB device and use that for the touch and then have your two monitors open to the desktop? I mean, would that be a solution that might work? Oh, you know, you muted, Brian. Sorry, hold on. Unmute for me. As soon as you can find it. And while Brian's unmuting himself, I'll remind folks, if you're listening to this, we just showed a whole bunch of stuff. If you're listening to the audio only, come out to YouTube, just search The Average Guy on YouTube and find the video and watch it. Brian, is that something you could do?
You can do it. I've actually played with it like that, because that's how I actually was playing with it at work. We had a old yellow touchscreen 1024 or 1120 by 1024 monitor that I had hooked into a Dell laptop. Problem is where I would find it bad with users, especially, is touching on one screen and not being able to touch on the other.
Yeah, no, for sure. I'm just thinking it's a natural surface to have that laying down on the desk to touch. It's like a mouse. It's like a big touchscreen mouse, right?
If they can make it where that is the combination secondary screen that maybe your email or your alerts show up at, and also could be the equivalent to my Logitech trackpad or your Apple Magic Mouse or Magic Pad, that would be great.
Yeah. No, I could see some great idea there, Christian, to make that work. So good stuff. That, you know, you'd mentioned the power supply on the Raspberry Pi. We talked a little bit about that on the last show. The USB hub idea is the best idea I've heard yet. So you get a powered USB hub that has the right voltage, mm-hmm. and then you come off the hub to power the Pi, and then you go off the Pi back into the hub, and then the hub runs all the peripherals on it. Yep. So it's kind of an all-in-one unit, and I imagine it would also strip down and fit it in a box.
I got this really little case for my Raspberry Pi that's a Pi on top, and it twists in, and it looks like a Pi, and it's a red
nice.
Pi with the
nice.
Mat. It's cool. Yeah.
Anybody else messing with the Pi yet? Brian, you are? You have one?
Yeah, I have two.
And what are you hoping to do with it?
Right now I am reworking one to run some PLCs to be my to monitor for my home monitoring setup my water meter.
Oh, yeah. Well, I know home automation is really, these things can be targeted really well for home automation. So
they're perfect for stuff like home automation or to have something in the that you mount on a wall that is very low voltage that could run with like even a touchscreen like Christian showed us here that could be your whole automation control, and it's basically in a shadow frame box almost on your wall, or you can even embed it in your wall and not be taking up a lot of space.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Okay, well, cool. Andrew, have you got one yet? You thinking about it?
They're not available in Australia at the moment.
Really?
The distributors run out.
Oh, okay. Oh, so you can get them. It's just they're out.
That's through Newark for you guys, right?
Sorry?
That's through Newark 14?
RS Components, I think.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
Yeah, but the if I got one, I'd probably have a look at the XBMC port that they've done to it to get rid of the Xbox Classic.
Okay.
And because our TV's got USB ports on it as well, so hopefully you'd be able to, you know, power the device off the TV and then feed it back in through HDMI.
Yeah, John talks a little bit about how you check the power to make sure, because not all USB ports are built the same.
Yeah, and exactly.
He talks about, you know, coming off USB, plug it into the mini USB port. Can't make a mistake there. That's the only port on there that works. And then you put the multimeter across T1 and T2, and it needs to read 5 volts. Otherwise, the thing will not work correctly. So some good info on the Raspberry Pi on that podcast. Go back and check it out. Nathaniel, have you been toying with it? Me neither. So don't feel bad. Me neither.
No.
Okay. I just haven't had the time. It's like, oh, my God, it's another thing.
Have you ordered? Do you have one?
No, I don't have one.
Oh. Well, you could order one, and you'd still be 6 months before it shows up.
That's a good point.
I know. I should probably get one and just have it. But it's just been one of those things. I've been knee-deep in server testing and some other things, and I just have not had the time. And, you know, a few podcasts every week, and haven't got to it yet. So we found some really good guys to do some podcasting around it, and we'll certainly have to bring, now that I know the two of you are messing with it right now, maybe we'll come back around and do another Raspberry Pi podcast and bring you on and you can talk about it. Christian, I think I'd really like to hear about the stuff that you're doing with the monitor as you get going on that, for sure.
Yeah.
And then, Brian, we'd want to hear how you've integrated that in with your irrigation system, right?
Sure.
Yeah, very cool. Okay, anything else, Christian?
No, that's a wrap.
Awesome. Well, guys, we've gone really long. I knew we would with the five of us on here, but some really good content tonight. Nathaniel, thanks for coming out and giving us the presentation on password and password security. This makes a perfect complement to Rich's Random Podcast 20. So go out and listen to that. That's already out on the site. We talked to LastPass and get some really good inside information with them. Then come back. Well, by the time it's already too late. You've listened to the show. Go listen to Rich's show. It's good. Talks about LastPass. Nathaniel, thanks for coming on tonight.
You're welcome. It was fun.
You bet. We'll have to have you back. Will you come back anytime I ask you?
Yeah.
Yes.
I just got to fit it in the schedule of soccer.
Yeah.
And, you know.
No, we'll try and adhere to maybe an every 7 or 8 or 9 week schedule. So you'll have plenty of time.
That sounds great.
Yeah. Thanks for coming on. Brian, always good to have you on, and thanks for your contribution tonight and that which you bring. I hope you feel better.
Oh, I'm beginning to feel better. My toes have a little bit of feeling finally. So.
Podcasting under any conditions. I love that. Christian, great to have you back in Buffalo, and great to have you on the podcast. And then a new site. Do you want to send people there to look at that at all? Or
I had Keith, one of our listeners, was able to get out there this week. So if you want to look at it, Christian-Johnson.net, and I'll send you an access.
And that's kind of your online resume/life/work development site. That's all good. Andrew, always great to have you back, and you think you'd be good for the show notes this week? That's all that's really important to me.
Yeah, I should be able to find some time to squeeze him into my schedule.
Good to have you back, and hopefully we can get 2 or 3 weeks in a row with you.
I know, what's with it? It's been far too long.
Yeah, it has. And Sarah keeps saying, God, we got to get to Australia. So I got to figure out a way to get on the plane and get over there and see you guys. It would be great.
Yeah, absolutely.
Doesn't Gallup have to do some political polls down there this year?
Yeah, they do. I'm trying to figure out a way. Yeah, exactly. I'm trying to figure out a way. Maybe I can do a strengths coaching session in Melbourne.
Down at the Melbourne office.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if we have them. I know we have one in Sydney. I'm not sure we are in Melbourne.
I think there's a Melbourne one.
Okay, yeah, I have to double check. We're in 39, we have 39 different global offices, so we ought to have one there. If we don't, maybe I should open one.
Yeah, that's it.
How's that sound? If you're out there in YouTube or have watched off Google Plus or out at theaverageguy.tv/live, thanks for coming out tonight. Quite a few of you out there. Great conversation. We do it every single week, Thursday nights, 8 p.m. Central, 9 Eastern, live with chat, and it's always good to have you out there. We also record it both audio and video. Audio is available on the site through the various RSS feeds. Don't forget, we're looking for an Android or an iPhone developer who wants to maybe make a little cash off of us, and you can get out there and develop an app. I don't think it would be very difficult. If you have questions on that, send me an email, podcast@theaverageguy.tv. We'll do it all again next week. Guys, thanks for coming in this evening, and look forward to next Thursday. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Night.
Have a good one.